When it comes to race relations, Michigan has quite a mixed history. Yes, this was a hotbed of abolitionist activity, including the founding of the anti-slavery Republican Party in Jackson. And Michigan was also part of the Underground Railroad movement, with many freedom seekers striving to get to Canada. But on the flip side, following the Civil War and well into the 20th century, Michigan was home to numerous sundown towns where African Americans feared for their lives after sunset. So just what was the experience for African Americans in Michigan prior to the Civil War? Annalisa Cox is a PhD and a non-resident fellow with the Hutchins Center at Harvard University. She's currently doing history research in Michigan. Annalisa, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
We're also talking with Deandra Johnson. She's Midwest Regional Coordinator for the Network to Freedom Program, part of the National Parks Service. Day, welcome to Stateside.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You know, there's a story that's been making the rounds in some white churches in Michigan, that this state was a near nirvana for freedom seekers. And the way the narrative goes, no freedom seekers who made it to Michigan from slavery in the South were returned to slavery because towns and churches had this system. If slave catchers were nearby, the churches would ring their bells to give warning. Have either of you ever heard this story? And do you know if there's any truth to it?
No, I have never heard that story before in any capacity. And so that's a very interesting, but there were freedom seekers who made it to Michigan that were returned. One of the most famous kind of incidences that happened was here in Michigan was in 1841 with Nelson Hackett. And he actually escaped from Arkansas and made it to Canada. And actually, his slave owners came to Michigan and were able to get the governor to issue an extradition order to bring him back from Canada to Michigan. And it's quite an involved story that happened. But it's interesting that the Canadian government actually pushed back against the request for extradition, saying that Michigan could not make the request as Hackett had escaped from Arkansas. But the Canadian government ended up extraditing him, not because he escaped from slavery, but because he had taken with him other articles of his owner's or slaveholder's property with him. So I think no state in the Northwest Territory was altogether anti-slavery. There was always a different mix of ideas and people. People were pro-slavery. There's other cases that happened here in Michigan where people were returned to slavery. But there also was, at the same time, even if a decision was made to return them to slavery, there were segments of the population, most often members of the African American population, that really provided resistance to this type of return. And so I think it's important to really note African-American resistance to this movement, because when we look at kind of traditional constructions of the Underground Railroad, it's usually constructed in terms of white benevolence. And African-Americans are made kind of secondary characters in stories that are largely about their own struggles for self-determination and freedom. So I think that's an interesting dimension of Underground Railroad in Michigan, because you do have such an outpouring of African-American activity, both who had achieved their freedom either legally or extra legally by escaping in other means.
Yeah,
and Day makes a really good point there. And I think it's one that gets really lost in these kind of mythologies, April, and that is that there were people of African descent in the state of Michigan before the end of slavery, before the Civil War, and they were hugely active as Underground Railroad operatives. And in fact, it was white Michiganders who often opposed their actions, including in Detroit in the early 1830s, when it was white Michiganders who arrested a couple who had lived in the village of Detroit. And I use that term very judiciously, because in 1830, Detroit was a village of roughly 2,000 people. So people really knew each other. These were neighbors. And it was white Michiganders who rounded up this couple who had been living there for over a decade and imprisoned them. And it was African Americans in Detroit who tried to rescue them. Then there was a terrible kind of racial massacre on the level of what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma in the 1920s, where whites rose up in retaliation. White Michiganders rose up in retaliation against Black Underground Railroad operatives and freedom seekers in the village of Detroit in the early 1830s.
Day, can you tell us a little bit more about how the Underground Railroad worked in Michigan?
Yeah, I think it morphed similar to other places that, you know, it began as kind of a loose network of people, and really people had to make split decisions. Like, it wasn't like they had, you know, when we conceptualize the Underground Railroad as a train, you know, the railroad, it wasn't like there was a schedule and they knew when people were coming. So oftentimes it was people who were faced and had to make a decision in the moment whether to lend assistance and help to someone who they found in need of it. And I think over time, though, as laws were passed and activities happened, that it became more organized and more deliberate. And you see that particularly after the passage of the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, which required citizens to participate in the recapture of freedom seekers. And a lot of Michiganders who maybe had been on the fence before really saw this as an affront to them personally and began to become more active in the Underground Railroad.
As one of the states that borders Canada, I've got to believe that just the geographic position of Michigan probably made it a pretty important spot. Were there other factors that contributed to that as well?
Yeah, I think transportation networks, both when the railroad came, but both the Great Lakes, it being on the Great Lakes, and so that shipping industry, and I think Annalisa can talk to you more about that, but also just African-American presence, and that you do have this migration of different groups who are definitely anti-slavery. Because even if you look at kind of settlement patterns, if you notice, free African-Americans are often settling near demographics that they believe would be sympathetic to their plight. And so you see them settling near Quakers or Congregationalists or New School Presbyterians. They were looking for places where they could experience as much as possible in that time period, some type of welcoming environment.
Annalisa Cox, what can you tell us about the maritime industry with respect to the Underground Railroad?
Well, this is something that a few maritime specialists in Michigan and the Midwest are just beginning to explore. One of the things we forget is that the Great Lakes used to be filled with ships. It was the best way of traveling around before the Civil War. And those ships had African-American staff members on them. So they were working those ships. They were extremely expert, and they were helping freedom seekers to escape aboard those ships. And that was happening around the UP. It was happening in all of the Great Lakes. So this was an Underground Railroad that was also used the waterways to escape. And one of the important points to make is that Michigan was actually a very much a frontier state. And there were, of course, indigenous people here before the Civil War, but a lot of the state was not settled. I mean, in 1830, the entire non-indigenous population of this state was 31,000 people. So freedom seekers, of course, were not protected by a series of church bells. There were no church bells across the state of Michigan that could even hear each other, right, before the Civil War. So that argument doesn't even have a very strong historical sense about what the state looked like before the Civil War. And what it looked like was mainly rural, no big cities, and people who were trying to seek freedom in this border state, sometimes their freedom was being resisted by white Michiganders.
Was it common for whole communities to stand together in Michigan? I'm thinking of the 1847 Kentucky raid in Battle Creek, which is one of the positive stories. I mean, can we say that communities across Michigan were largely of one mind, either for or against slavery?
Dale, I'll let you answer that one, because, of course, there's also the Cass County 47 raid as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, they're connected. They're not separate events. So what happened was that this group of slave catchers and slave holders from Kentucky came into Michigan looking for their property. They first went to Battle Creek, and a resistance movement was led by Erastus Hussey, who was a Quaker, who propelled them back. That group went back to Indiana, and then they got further intel about where the freedom seekers were, and that led them to Cass County, and then that raid broke out there. And so in both the Battle Creek and the Cass County raid, you have this connection with those that are providing the resistance. In addition to the free Blacks that have already settled in these places, you also have these Quaker communities also bolstering this resistance to these Kentucky raiders. So I think that's an interesting thing. And I think in other communities that you also have some resistance, but there always is a mix. Like, there might be a majority, but there's always some outliers. So one of the events I'm thinking of is in that same year, earlier in the year, is the Crosswhite family affair, and that was in Marshall, Michigan. And you mentioned bells, and that is an incident where slave catchers from Kentucky came up into Calhoun County, where Marshall is located, and attempted to recapture a family, Adam, Sarah, and their four children, and take them back to Kentucky. They were first propelled back. They broke into the Crosswhite's home, attempted to capture them. They were propelled back by the African-American community there who provided resistance. And one of the kind of, I don't know, myths or kind of the folklore of it is that an African-American man who rang the bell at the local auctions went down the streets ringing the bell, alerting people to the fact that these slave hunters were in the area. And then members of the white population also provided resistance to these slave catchers, arresting them and putting them in jail for kidnapping and other crimes, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this makes one of the difficulties about African Americans really protecting their freedom is that they did not have those same protections under the law. Search and seizure, all those things did not apply to them that we now, you know, our touchstones and our Bill of Rights was really hard for African Americans to be protected under those same things that we now, you know, consider inviolate. And so I think that's one of the interesting things that happens there. But of course, in Detroit, you have a lot of community resistance there. But Detroit is going to be a mix of people, both pro-slavery and anti-slavery. So I think it's hard to say, like, you do have a community where the balance is leans more to one side. But I don't know if you can ever say an entire community is one way or the other.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with Day Johnson, Midwest Regional Coordinator for the Network to Freedom Program for the National Park Service, and with Annalisa Cox, a non-resident fellow with the Hutchins Center at Harvard University. Were there ways, Day Johnson, that information was communicated along the Underground Railroad about towns or areas that freedom seekers should avoid or might be safe in?
Yeah, and it's hard to know those communication patterns. What's interesting is that most African Americans sought out first communities of color, and then from their networks, it spread out into getting white assistance. And that's usually the way that it happened. But I mean, it's so hard. And this is one of the questions that I would think needs further investigation, is that there seems to be a lot of back and forth between people who made it to the North and people who were in the South. And I think we have not even begun to grasp those communication systems, because one of the interesting things that we're noticing is that people who escaped from an area at different points in time all end up settling eventually in the same places in the North. And so there has to be some communication system. What that is it word of mouth? Are people able to write letters to certain people? This is not in Michigan, but we know with Harriet Tubman that she wrote letters to someone that was free. And then from there, the information was disseminated about escaping and different things like that. So I think we have not even begun to like scratch the surface of these vast communication networks. And one of the interesting things that I was looking at is how important postmasters were. I was reading a letter from an abolitionist, and he writes about his excitement that they got a postmaster, and the postmaster was of an anti-slavery ilk. And he says, this means I will be able to communicate more freely. And we don't think about postmasters today being able to read information about, you know, read your mail, essentially. So that communication network seems to be important if we glean that from that letter I told you that came from that anti-slavery activist about the postmaster.
I mean, to think that there was actually a written network of communication, that sounds incredibly daring given what the stakes were for all these people.
it was incredibly brave, but it's also important to remember that people of African descent were literate, and they did use their literacy to combat bondage and to combat slavery. And there were communication networks. And in fact, people traveled a lot. I've come across incidents where people who made it into a free state then traveled back down into the South to get the rest of their family members. But as Day so wisely pointed out, these are networks primarily of African Americans with some white assistance. This is not, as the myth would have it, a sort of paternalistic, benevolent white Michiganders assisting helpless African American freedom seekers. This is actually about African American agency. And one of the reasons we know so little about this is that historians like myself have been ignoring this history for so long, and sometimes even misrepresenting it to favor the history of white Michiganders over the truth of the past and the histories of Black Michiganders.
I wonder if either of you think that it's a stretch to compare the systems that developed under the Underground Railroad to those people who today might help immigrants coming north from Michigan who might be on the run from ICE or other federal officials.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, April. One of the ways that we can think about it is those people who are trying to stand up to ICE are not particularly popular. There's not a whole lot of them. And I think that one of the lessons we can draw from the past is that this is not the vast majority of Michiganders who were involved in the Underground Railroad. And it was not a hugely popular movement before the Civil War. And in fact, there were a lot of white Michiganders who thought that they were upholding the federal law by capturing freedom seekers and returning them to the South. They thought of themselves as law-abiding citizens, returning property to where it goes. And these are horrific words to us today, but I think it's really important to remember that this was not a fashionable movement or a popular movement in the state of Michigan. And Day made mention of the fact that this was particularly risky work for people of African descent in the state of Michigan before the Civil War because they had so little protection under the law. And I think it's really important for us to remember in this election year, as we move towards an election, that a majority of white Michiganders opposed equal representation and the right to vote for their African American neighbors in the state of Michigan, even though when Michigan was first carved out and became part of the United States in 1787, African Americans were promised the right to vote in this region when it was still a territory. And that promise was broken and that right was stolen by white Michiganders in 1819, when the first territorial government document was written up, and they excluded African Americans from the right to vote and the right to vote for who would represent them in 1819. And that right to vote continued to be opposed by white Michiganders through the Civil War, a Civil War in which African Americans from Michigan fought and died for the liberty of all people in the United States. And it was, in fact, in 1867, a new constitution for the state of Michigan was written and was turned down by a majority of white Michiganders. And that new constitution included the right for Black people to vote, and it was turned down. It was in 1867. So we have to remember this isn't just about slavery versus freedom. This is also about equality versus prejudice. And these are issues that people in the state of Michigan have wrestled with for a long time and continue to wrestle with.
Day, what do you wish more people understood about the way the Underground Railroad worked in Michigan?
That's a hard one. I think Dr. Cox brought up some really good points about, you know, we assume because a place was anti-slavery, had Underground Railroad activity, that people were for pro-Black or for Black equality, and that's not the case. I think we also have to remember that slavery existed in Michigan. And so they had these prohibitions against slavery, but slavery existed in what would become the state of Michigan. And so when you have slavery, these ideas that help to bolster it, these ideas of prejudice and racism, don't disappear. And I think it's important that we realize that, because also it's important to realize that because we have Michigan also being a destination, not only because people escaping from the South, but before in the 1700s and early 1800s, you have people escaping from Canada, where slavery was illegal, to Michigan for freedom. And so I don't think people really grapple with that idea either, that people actually escaping from the North to the South, which would Michigan, or depending on where you are in Michigan, if it's North or South, that people were escaping to Michigan from Canada. And so I think that's one of the things that I think people don't understand, that just how pervasive slavery was. We tend to create this false dichotomy, right? North is free, South is a slave, and the two never meet. But actually, slavery was quite pervasive, not only in North America, period. And so I think this has done a really great disservice to our understanding of just how instrumental and pervasive this was in our country. And that's why the Underground Railroad stands out. When you think about just how pervasive slavery was, that there were people who were willing to risk their own lives to either escape or to assist others, I think it makes it just, even if they were a small part of the population, I think it magnifies their efforts and shows that even in the roughest and the most strenuous times, there are things that people did. They worked together across bounds of race, gender, religious organizations to believe, because they believed that they were righting something that was wrong. And I think this is one of the first grassroots movements of our country. And even today, people still, the Underground Railroad is a touchstone for current day social justice movements. And if, you know, there's all these arguments as, was the Underground Railroad successful? And I think it depends about how you look at it. But for each of those lives it touched, I would say it was a great success. It gave them opportunities, even if the places that they went to weren't free from racial strife, it gave them opportunities that they otherwise would have never have had.
Dandra Johnson is Midwest Regional Coordinator for the National Park Service's Network to Freedom program within the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. We've also been talking with Annalisa Cox, PhD, with the Hutchins Center at Harvard University. She is sited in Michigan for now. Annalisa, Day, it's really great to hear your voices. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity.